And today I thought, in a way, it's partly as a preparatory for tomorrow, look at something around the Salata Sutta, one of the Buddha's discourses with his monks. And they're sort of relevant to each other. So if you're coming tomorrow, this is like a good base for tomorrow as well. So I've lived at Vajralokha now for 10 years, just the 5th of November, 10 years I've been there. It's an extraordinary long time. And I think one of the things for me about living there has been a sort of a process around trying to clarify, a clarification process around what is a thought about things and what's a sensate experience. So that's been one of the most important things that I've been sort of clarifying. It seems like a fine point, but we're constantly creating our worlds. So we're constantly creating our worlds by our thoughts about the worlds, our concepts about the worlds, the way we think the world is. And there's a tendency for us to overlay our experience, our ordinary experience, with thoughts about experience. And then that has a very strong colouring effect on our relationship to the world. You know, most of you will know the idea of the realms, the Tibetan wheel of life, and the different realms. And in some ways, you could have all be in the same world, but all people experiencing different realms, from hell realms to heaven realms. But actually, the same thing's happening. And what's overlaying it so much is our thoughts about what is happening, and so that colours our experience of what actually is happening. And the Salata Sutta, so this is the sutta I was going to talk about, the Salata Sutta is the Buddha telling the assembly to pay attention. He's telling the assembly to pay attention to what actually is happening in experience. So, what we're going to do now, if we just sit reasonably comfortably, we don't have to be in perfect meditation mode, but just reasonably comfortably. So just contact the breath, first of all. Breath coming and going. And then a sense of kindly attentiveness. And then bring your awareness to the toes. The sensations of the toes. try to force anything, just sort of ordinary attention. Sensations. Then the sensations of the breath. And then being aware of the thinkers. And opening the eyes. So, would anyone like to say what happened when I said bring attention to the toes? Some who've been to Vajraloka know the answer.
Answer.
So just see.
I wrinkled my toes.
Yes.
Because I wasn't aware of them before you said it. And just to get an idea of where my toes actually were, I started to wriggle.
Yes.
To be aware of my big toes.
Yes.
The rest of them didn't feel like they existed.
Yes.
In terms of, I didn't move them, but I could feel sensation in my big toes, but not in the others.
I started to think that they were cold, which I hadn't been thinking about before.
It felt like an electrical charge, tingling.
I feel the soles of my feet very cold, and my feet are like feet like ice. You know, they kept getting colder and colder.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel the pressure difference between each foot of the toes, and then I got everything to thinking that actually one was fully on the mat, one was half off the mat, and I had to stop myself doing the rationalisation thing and just come back to how they actually felt.
Yeah.
I could be aware of all of my toes because there's too many of them. It would move around different toes.
Yeah. And when I said bring your attention to the fingers, what was that like then?
I noticed there's like a lot of sensation that I just hadn't noticed before.
Yeah.
That actually just a lot going on, but I've been completely unaware of it.
Yeah.
A lot easier than being aware of the toes.
Yes, I agree.
Yes, that's interesting.
Just to bore you, a lot of electrical energy again.
My hands felt like on fire compared to my feet.
Yeah.
I find that the attention is very momentary, so the so when you give the instructions or say then you're there, but then very quickly it's quite easy to do a very short space of time, but for the space of time that you're suggesting you do, I find them
the mind's going off.
Back in the way.
Yeah,
you can quickly get into sort of associative thinking about the hands or so coming back to the sensation. So you have to keep doing it. I had to keep doing it.
I suspect you're not alone. It's really good. I'll say a little bit more, but it's really worth doing this in preparation when you're preparing to meditate, particularly around something like the mindfulness of eating, and the metta-bhava, whatever it is you're doing, and the just sitting practice, coming into a relationship with a particular part of the body and noticing. So when I do it, what tends to happen is that there's it's like I've got this mental map. Does that make sense? Like I've got this mental map which sort of has a location, toes. Does that make sense? So it's worth noticing that takes place. Quite often that takes place very quickly. But in a way, that's a concept. That's an idea. So that's like the mind has this, it thinks it's useful, and it might be useful, as sort of a locating thing. And an aspect of that might be like a wiggling thing. So there's a wiggling thing might go on just to get a sense of where we are. But yeah, just noticing how the mind does that. So that's not a problem, but it's good just to see it, that there's a thought process going on. Because sometimes the thought process begins to overlay the experience. And then once I've sort of acknowledged that, then I tend to experience some sort of tingliness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then shake your head. So there might well be some sort of tingliness there, sort of like an energy. Now, some people don't get it for some sort of neurological reason or whatever. They don't necessarily get tingly tingles, but there'll be some sort of sensation, which is more tangibly a sort of a physical sensation, which isn't so much a thought. Does that make sense? What I'm saying? And that the sensation sort of, if you notice more and more, the experience changes. It might be quite quick, like you were describing, the flickeriness of it. So it's just good to notice what is happening within the sensate experience. And it's really good to be... it's really good to have periods where, in terms of like a body scan, where you're noticing that. You're noticing the sensate quality of the coming and going of the sensations, that things just come and go. This is like a little Dharma door into seeing that things are impermanent, that things just come and go. So it's a really useful way in to seeing that a bit more clearly within our ordinary experience. But so there's that tingliness, but there's also then there might be experiences of temperature or qualities which we begin to label. We begin to label with ideas. So it might be a quality of temperature, and it might be cold, or it might be warm, and there might be a preference begins to come in. I like warm, but the cold is uncomfortable, a bit painful. Does that make sense? That sort of... So again, it's noticing what the mind is doing. it's going all painful, pleasurable, and then quite often the tingliness, which can at first be a bit neutral, is just ignored. So it's and I think this area is becoming refining our sensibility to what we usually ignore. So that sort of area of the sensate experience is quite often, it's sort of there, but until we really pay attention to it, we don't notice it. But the more we pay attention to it, the more we notice it on an ongoing basis, the more in touch with our physical sensate experience. But it's really good to notice how we a painful feeling, we try and sort of hold it away, or we try and move onto something else. Let me just stay there, because I don't want to jump too far ahead of myself, because I'm just jumping a bit ahead of myself. So there's also, it's like, even with a simple exercise like that, it can begin then to move into stories about the experience. Oh, this is cold. Oh, I'm not feeling anything. He's asking me to feel something. I'm not feeling anything. Oh, I must be awful at this. So things can start moving in that direction. Oh, I found the tingles. This is brilliant. I'm brilliant. So it can move in all sorts of different directions in relationship to a simple experience. And it's that thing. It's not a bad thing that we're telling a story about the world. The problem is if we go on believing it in all situations. So we tend to make stories about the world and then go on believing them. And we tell each other stories about the world, trying to convince each other of our world. And then there's a playing out of stories rather than being in relationship to what's actually happening to us. In the Salata Sutta, the Buddha says that it's like two darts. He says it's like two darts. So first of all, we experience what might be a painful experience, and it might be a physically, what we would describe as a physically painful experience, or it might be an emotional painful experience. A shock, emotionally, bereavement, or whatever, a loss. So there's an immediate experience. And the Buddha says what tends to happen for... What he says, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So, the run-of-the-mill person, us, so the experience of pain, defined as pain, there's a response to that of distress. In a way, that's quite natural. But then, a whole set of mental processes can start up. A whole set of mental processes can start up about the nature of the pain. So the initial experience of the suffering is, in a way, lost in the larger experience of suffering, or the second dart, as a second dart goes in, which is around our story about that loss or pain and previous experiences, previous relationships. So about, oh, it's like this all the time, or it's like, oh, they're like that, the world's like that, oh, I'm hopeless. So it reinforces and covers over the initial experience of pain. Now, I expect probably we can recognise that. If we can't, it's well worth looking. It's well worth looking. Even like a simple thing like, oh, that's cold. Just how the stories proliferate around that experience. So it's really well worth looking for that. And he said, the Buddha says, well, this is the cause of suffering. This is the cause of suffering. Because not only do you have the two darts, you have the initial pain, which is bad enough, but you've added on to it, and then you think, I don't like this, I'm going to go after some pleasure. I'm going to go after some pleasure. So you shoot off in response to, particularly the second dart, in pursuit of pleasure, or something to assuage that experience of suffering. That's sort of completely understandable. Why would you want to go on suffering if you can get a bit of pleasure? If you can get a bit of pleasure. So it's completely understandable as a response. The only problem is that all things come to an end. So the pleasure runs out, and then you're back. And you're back quite often with the stories about the pain and about the suffering. And you shoot off, try and get some pleasure, then you're back, and then you're sort of on the wheel, as it were, on the wheel. And you've missed an opportunity. That's what the Buddha said. You've missed the opportunity to see that there is a way to be in relationship to the initial experience that doesn't need you to move off into stories or into pursuing pleasure. So pleasure isn't necessarily a bad thing. So question?
Yes, within Buddhist phraseology, is there such a thing in Buddhism as transcendentalism of the cosmos plane?
Well, the less you keep going into the cycle of pain and pleasure, the more likely you are that you're going to recognise what's actually happening. And that then can draw you into a relationship to what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And one might describe that as a transcendental plane, or it might be simply what's happening.
Yeah.
So the more...
Thank you very much.
That's okay. So the more you're in contact with what's actually happening in experience... So you've got the initial experience of the proverbial brick falling on your toe, which there'll be discomfort, but then actually the discomfort ends. All things are impermanent, and the discomfort might be uncomfortable, and it will have a sensate quality to it, but it doesn't necessarily start having to reinforce emotional reactions and stories about it. And the more you can sort of stay with the sensations of the experience, the more likely that you can see the qualities of the experience that, well, dukkha is part of our lives. Dukkha, or a degree of suffering, is just part of being human. It's just part of life. Things come and go, and sometimes it's a bit dukkha-ish, sometimes it's quite pleasant. Things come and go. The more that you're in touch with the initial experience, the less you're spun off, and the more likely that you can contact and recognise the nature of dukkha and the nature of impermanence and substantiality. The more you can that you can be in touch with that, and the less you're caught. The less you're caught. So that's quite a rush through. So. Any questions or comments?
Got one.
Yeah.
When you started, you said, like if I locate my toes at the end of my feet, I was just thinking, where is the mind residing? Where is it coming from? Where is it going to? Is it just momentary that it's used?
doesn't have a physical entity. It's just where you're bringing presence to within your experience. Mm. So even that's conceptual?
Well, there's a question, isn't it? It's a question. So it's with a kindly, and this is really important, with a kindly attention, noticing what's actually happening. With a kindly attention, noticing what's happening. It's a bit like, you know, if you're in contact with the sensations, there's sensations. That sort of makes sense.
Yeah, I just think the ability of the mind to expand and embrace experience is enormous.
Yeah. And the more you notice, the more you're likely to notice. I think there's a, so you've had one, so I'm going to go with it, and I'll come back to you. I'll come back to you.
Yeah, okay.
Because you've had one, so I'll go with it. I will come back. Yeah. So I'll go with it.
So if fear is part of the suffering, is fear a sensate experience or a story about the sensation?
Mm. So that's, so it, fear, in a sense, is a story. But it's like there will be a physical component as part of it, a physical and emotional experience as part of it. The less tight one is in relationship to what's arising, the more awareness accommodates the experience, and the less that the fear potentially dominates, so that the more open one is to the experience rising and falling away, the less narrow the focus. So the fear, in a way, is just part of the experience. But it's, again, it's, this is, in theory, this is straightforward. In reality, there's fear, and it's overpowering. And sometimes it overpowers. So it's just, but the more awareness in relationship to the experience, the more it's possible to see quite a lot's going on in terms of the physical body, the mind telling a story, and the more one can, in a way, let it run its course and run out. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But it's not like it's easy. It's not like it's easy, is it? You know, meditation, not like, you know, follow the breath. It's just like the simplest thing in the world, except when you actually start trying to do it, when all sorts of stuff starts. So it's like, you know, paying attention to what's actually happening in terms of that sensate experience and the emotions. Well, it's not easy. And so it's not being disappointed when one spins off. That's what I'm trying to say. A quick one then.
Yes. Would you say that Buddhism is more influential as opposed to Scientology? Because I had a friend of mine that was deceased in March of 2014, and he and I used to argue at which end that I maintained that Buddhism is far more influential than. Than the works of one habit of Scientology, because there was a documentary on Scientology. The way they treat their guests at the headquarters in Eastbourne, there's no way I would have been involved with Scientology. Because, I mean, Scientology is con people out there. I had a lot of bloody money. I mean, yeah. I talked
that's
about.
That's okay. I got your question. I got your question. So, it's not a question I can answer for us here right now. Buddhism is relevant.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd say. I think it's, you know, obviously I'm sat here in the case wrong. So I'd say that Buddhism is offering a way to to recognise more and more about what's happened for ourselves and for us to be in better connection with other people. So that's what I'd like to say about that. So I go with
it. It was more an observation, really, but when I've managed to catch myself, just in the sense of, you know, the initial experience, it can, even when I catch myself, I can still, you know, this mental proliferation can still override that.
Yeah.
And then I find it self-enforcing as well. So I'd have possibly a negative thought or a fearful thought or something, and it kind of just builds and builds upon. And I wonder if that also links to the samskaras or kind of our habitual tendencies.
Yeah.
Is that what's building our habits? And then and then because we have these habitual kind of reactions, it just becomes more, we just fall into these tendencies more and more, and it becomes harder to cultivate awareness.
Well, that's it. Very well put. So we do. We there's a tendency to reinforce. And I'll just go back. Sometimes it hits a point where the best thing is to actually seek something else. But, you know, I got to stay with my experience, it's just so painful and so difficult. Well, actually, do something else.
Yeah.
Do something else. So that's really quite important. So what I'm not saying is just stay with your experience, whatever. Sometimes the best thing in terms of a relationship to a certain habit of fear or anxiety is actually just do something else. And actually that's a really good action in terms of its sort of karmic effect. But we do reinforce patterns. We do, how we respond now is because of the way we responded before. You know, how we've responded to situations now is how we've, you know, been built up from responses before. So, but the more we recognise them in terms of not just as an idea, but as a holding pattern, the less effect they can have on us. And in a way, the more we can be aware of that sort of holding pattern of emotion and physicality, the more likely it can sort of resolve itself back into awareness. So who was next? Was it yourself?
Just a comment. I'm a diabetic.
Yes.
And if you're a diabetic, there's a thing called diabetic neuropathy, which sounds very, very much like what you're describing. In other words, these sensations in your toes and your fingers are there all the time.
Yes.
The medical profession will attempt to treat you to stop you having those sensations.
I think, well, that's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting. Yes, I can sort of understand that in a way, because suddenly there you are with actual sensations.
Your toes on fire.
Disconcerting. Yeah.
I've just been really grateful to learn. I mean, I've kind of been learning about this for a while, and I find when I get it right, I can sort of see. Like I think of as my cleverer or higher me, and then my other me that goes up. But I find it really helps to imagine two yous, and then having the one that goes off is like a child, and you kind of watch it going off. And like I've just been so grateful to discover all the stories and kind of see them for the stories. And just, I mean, it's not easy, like you say, but just even just on a rational level, knowing that we do this has just been a real relief, actually.
Do you think it's helpful to kind of get a sense of where the stories come from, or is that reinforcing?
It's interesting. That is interesting. Mm-hmm. I think being human, we want to find an answer. So it's almost like there's a strong volition to seek out an answer to a present discomfort. In some ways. Sometimes that's helpful, but sometimes it overlays, and rather than sometimes, like tension, emotional, physical tension held in the body. And this is where Balajit, who was mentioned at the interval, who used to live at Vajraloka, he's very good at this area. So the body's holding all sorts of stuff, in the way we sit. So, in a way, potentially, some of the stuff goes right back to pre-verbal, pre-verbal stuff. And in a sense, well, you might never know sometimes what the cause of something was. But what you can sometimes know is that something's released. Some attention just relaxes. It might be for a moment, or it might be just forever. And it's a bit like something's been resolved. And so, you know, therapies are good, I think, because it helps the mind relax and come into a relationship with the body and the emotions. So it's really good. And in a way, that sort of thing can be really helpful in terms of recognising the stories and, the explanations. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I suppose my sense, it's realising that there are stories, recognising what the stories are. Mm-hmm. But also sometimes the stories change.
Yes.
You might have different stories at different times for a specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or just different perspectives on
it.
So it's like not fixing the story. It's like, oh, that's because of what happened when I was three.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? You've got the person you know, a friend or whatever, and you know, some days the thought of getting together with them, you think, oh, fine, we've got to go and see that person. And another day, oh, great. So all the time, the story's, in a way, the story's just changing anyway, because of the mood we're in at any particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that the moods are bad, it's more that they're recognised as provisional.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're, you know, we are storytellers. We are storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
But they're provisional stories. And so the sort of recognising their provisional nature doesn't mean that you're setting yourself up just to be responding from the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I like doing these because I'm telling myself this all the time. You know, anyway, talking like this, it's just like I love the Salata Sutta because, oh my goodness. So I could just see myself, oh, a bit of pain, oh, I get some pleasure. I could just see it. So it's just really useful to have something that you just keep coming back to and just keep recognising within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about fear, which I know about 3 years ago when I came here, it was actually someone talking to us, and they said, if you have fear, open the door, welcome it in, and try and understand it, taste it, and touch it, and
yes,
so on. But I think there are certain fear which seems to be fundamental, which is, let's say you're being attacked by a wild animal, you will feel fear, because that's challenging you to do something, to run away or to fight.
Yeah.
But I think there's another sort of fear that we build up through experience, condition, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a fear of heights, which I'm trying to address and I'm improving, so I'm trying to call it fear.
Yeah.
But if I watch the television and there's someone climbing or a rock face, so my legs go really funny, and I can't watch. And even though I keep forcing myself to watch, I can't. So I'm sort of rambling a bit, I know, but there seems to be two things. There's one sort of fear which seems to be there for self-preservation, which is an understandable thing, and another which perhaps is through circumstances and conditions.
Yeah. Well, there definitely isn't there. We're human beings, but we're animals, and we've got fight and flight, and the response to flight and fight. And we've also got the animals freeze to, you know, if they think that they're trapped, they'll freeze and play dead. And aspects of us, I think, quite often also freeze. And I think quite often that's probably the deepest stuff that is informing our responses of fear and of anxiety and dread. And So I think that it's recognising what's going on. That natural, in a way, that natural fight or flight, it's a bit like there's an energetic side of it. I think the freeze size is a bit like one's caught, like the proverbial rabbit in the lights. So it's recognising the quality of what's going on.
I often find that there's, regardless of whether it's low level, high level, or pleasurable, usually a mixture of the situation, I often feel a bit overwhelmed because it can be so much sensation.
Yes.
And I guess it's really. Any tips on how to manage that?
Yeah.
Because what I then find is that I end up, it's too much to take in.
Yeah.
So then I sort of shut down.
Yeah.
So it's how to try and start to work with that more than try, but I think I do find that, you know, it can be very confusing. You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes just taking a walk in the park.
Yeah.
There are so many sensations. There's your physically walking sensations. There's what's going on around. There's the emotional. So many aspects.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's something that I've always struggled with. It's like how to work with that, I guess, a bit more in a manageable way. When, especially when you're not in a meditation setting, because I think, you know, it's also helpful in day-to-day situation.
So I think there's I think that ongoing relationship with the breath is really useful. There's an ongoing relationship with the breath. Not necessarily as like you're trying to get really concentrated, but there's just the simplicity of the breath. The breath is always there. It's a bit like it's your friend. So it's always there. It's always available for you to come back to. So, and in a way, just if that feeling of overwhelmingness, just coming back to the experience of the breath. And if that, in a way, that overwhelmingness, something's got out of kilter, it's just too much. So it's like, if you come back to the breath, not in a narrow way, but just in quite an ordinary way, and then see what happens from there. Mm-hmm. I think that there's like an ongoing relationship with the breath. Yeah.
It's interesting because sometimes I think we feel that awareness is awareness of everything that's going on at the moment, and that's not possible.
So I think that's a really good point, is that actually doctrinally that the mind can only stay with one thing. The awareness is aware of one thing at a time, and you know this one thing is take video crazy.
He's around.
But and that's why the mind or awareness likes to be the simplicity of something like the breath, because it's a resting. There's a resting back in the simplicity of that experience. Although a lot is happening with the breath, a lot of sensations and all that sort of thing, but there's a simplicity around it. So it's like one doesn't, you know, in those amazing moments where suddenly you're one with the universe and with it might be that anything. But if you're trying to get out, then that's, or if it's too much input, then just allow yourself to centre.
Sometimes when I bring awareness just to the raw sensations, it can feel just a little bit sort of, I know it's bringing experience to the actual direct experience, but it never feels a little bit remote or cold or even stark sometimes.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't seem to make a difference even if I try to relax around it or bring a sort of kindly attention to it. And I just wondered if you had any advice on that.
I think that that's why the metta-bhavana is really important. So like metta-bhavana is just really important. That, you know, that to come into relationship with more that sort of sensing quality, there's two things. One, it can be a bit, appear a bit boring, so that's one thing. And it can might even appear a bit frightening, like in a way that there's all these tingling. It might seem quite duty, wasn't it? Yeah, mm-hmm. quite extreme. So it could be two things. So there needs to be enough positivity.
Because of that comment you made there was, yes, I actually use the mindfulness of the breath to actually allow this to go away.
That's good.
If you're trying to pay attention to an area which is dark, where there is no sensation, do you have any tips?
Well, depends if it's dark.
Well, no, I mean, if it's simply unaware.
So, be aware. It's like if you're doing a body scan, be aware. So you know, I haven't a clue what's going on back here quite often, and less of that is uncomfortable that I know immediately what's going on back here. So it's just, in a sense, aware that there's apparently not much happening. And sometimes, if there's awareness, not much happening, then actually something begins to happen. Now we're moving on to just before by my watch 2:15, and we were going to do some chanting of the Shakyamuni mantra. So shall we do that now? Good. I don't know, do we stay like this, or we can stay like this? Thank you.